Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with a slightly delayed but nonetheless live and in living voice, personal wealth coach, actually the personal wealth coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Yeah.
Right, now we're ready to go home. We have said our names.
We have.
Yes.
We have spoken.
No.
So what we need to do is issue our proper disclosures, disclaimers, yes. Distortions. No, we don't do those. Okay.
How close were you?
This close.
Yes, exactly. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, and that's not a coincidence because the same two guys that are principals there are the voices on this program. Let's see. I told you who we're regulated by. The stuff that we talk about on here, stuff is a technical term, I realize, is intended to be educational and is not investment advice because investment advice is given individually and it is accurate to the best of our knowledge and we get it from sources we believe to be accurate, but we don't make any warranties, guarantees, and past performance is no guarantee of future return. Close cover before striking. Is there anything I forgot?
Unauthorized personnel only beyond this point. Unauthorized.
Right.
If you have not written a book, you may enter.
If you've not written a book?
Yeah, authorized would be only...
No, the book is authorized.
Book written.
Authors are not authorized.
Well, authorized personnel. I guess anybody that's been in a book, if you've ever been in a book, then you can go into the authorized personnel only signs. But
that makes sense. Well, let's see what happened during the week. I like the way that Barron's put it. The if the S&P 500 or stocks in general continued at the rate of return we have seen so far this year, if we annualize it out, which is a really popular thing to do in economics, then the stock market will triple this year.
Wait a minute.
Yes, I mean that's the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 507 points or 2% last week. The S&P 500 rose 1.6% last week.
What we could say there very easily, very quickly, to resolve that statement is that you shouldn't annualize these weekly numbers because they don't make any sense when you do.
Yeah. Well, how much higher could it go this year?
As high as the buyers let it go.
Yeah. Well, you know, we kind of follow the S&P 500, and I mentioned a little while back that we thought it was pretty interesting. It went through 2,500, and that's a benchmark, and we ought to look at that, and that's an important number to look. The S&P 500 closed out the week at 2,786.24, and it was just a short while ago.
That 0.24 is very important.
Well, it is because it's reported, but 2,786. The consensus, if you ask, and this I have to take the Barron's and the Wall Street Journal and so on's word for this, but they said that the Wall Street consensus of analysts has it hitting 2,893 by the end of the year, and 3,000 would be reasonable.
Yeah, prognosticators, when it comes to the consensus of what's expected for a market to do, are notoriously wrong. Should let everyone out there know that. That if we all get together and say, what do we think the market's going to do? Whatever we decide is probably the least likely option based on history.
But there's an argument. There's a good argument behind that. And that is earnings increases, when we look out a year into the future right now, conservatively, have all of the economic fundamentals. And by the way, earnings are what drive the market. The earnings, how much profit a company makes. We talk about the P.E. ratio, which is around 18 right now, a little over 18, price-to-earnings ratio, is pretty much the average going back the last 30 years for the S&P 500. And if earnings rise 17% this year, which the economic fundamentals are there. Now, whether they'll be interrupted somewhere along the way.
That's the big thing.
We could see some significant rise. Now, I don't think we're going to get another 20% like we've had the last 12 months.
Well, what I'd like to remind everyone, because it's easy to fall into this, is a year ago what the consensus was. And it was a much more negative consensus. It wasn't negative, but it was more negative than this new one. There was a pretty large consensus that it wasn't going to do anywhere near as well. The market wasn't going to do anywhere near as well as it did last year. In fact, there was a common mantra that has just disappeared. You don't hear anybody who said it come out and say, I said that and oops. And that is, this is the first year. Last year was the first year ending in the number 7 to not have a major catastrophic event in the market.
You are denigrating cats.
I am. Catastrophic events are whatever strophic is. The cats don't like it. So right. We should keep away from strophics, especially cat strophics.
Right.
So last year, for the first time since we've been measuring the stock market as a whole, was the first year ending in the number 7 that didn't have a massive
panic.
Downturn, a panic of some kind. You'll recall, most of us remember 2007, but
well, actually,
1997 had one, and 1987 had a big one.
You got to kind of stretch it to say that 2007 had a panic, because the panic really didn't begin until 2008.
No, but it began the downturn there, and
yeah.
You could see it has. So
you
basically,
could relate to it, right?
Well, what I'm saying is that determining the future is difficult.
Well, I like what
when it comes to market returns, we are a lot more accurate when we come when it
I
comes
like what
to
Yogi Berra said.
Economic activity
predicting is really, really hard, particularly when it concerns the future.
Yeah, predicting is really hard, especially when it concerns the future. Yes, that's it. And he also says the future is just not what it used to be.
That's true.
And totally true. Predicting the future return of a stock market. If we could do it, if the folks in that consensus could do it, we couldn't afford to read the report about the consensus, because that would mean someone has superpowers. Someone has the ability to really – they'd be the one that would be calling every election. And the reality is that
– they do call every election.
The economy is based on something different than the market. The market is most often based on the economy. But not always. When we get into big pessimism or big euphoria, what we see is the opposite in many cases. So people are really, 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 really pessimistic in the middle of an economic recovery. And they're really, 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 really euphoric at the middle of the plateauing of the economic activity. We're kind of in between those two points right now.
Well, I think what we've seen in presuming that someone is listening.
Even if they're not, we can talk to each other.
Right,
but I won't listen then either.
Last year, for most of the year, the news media and the people that I talked to were focused on the perceived threat that we would return to a recession.
Yes.
They were still thinking about the 2008-2009
Everybody
great recession.
Was pointing at Europe.
Bear market.
Pointing at Asia and saying, look, look.
And I think it's kind of dropped off the radar, and now it's that's what the article said. How high can it go?
Right. Yeah. Anytime that's the question in the article, and that's starting to begin to be the normal article, the normal thing that we're seeing. We've passed the point of pessimism. We're now into optimism. John Templeton has this quote that I love because it is behavioral economics before that was even a thing, which is bear markets are born on – or bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. Well, we are through the pessimism now, so we're beyond the youth stage of this bull market. We're into optimism. We're starting to see that being the normal headline.
And not coincidentally, there are several trend lines, including one that's just simply a trend line. If you subtract inflation out of the S&P 500 and you look at its total return over the last 40 years, and you can draw the computer will draw a nice little trend line along there, and it sticks amazingly close to that trend line for long periods of time, and then it departs either up or down. And however much up it goes, later you'll pay for it in down, so that it winds up on reversion to the mean. And we are right on that trend line right now, whereas since early 2008, we've been below the trend line which meant it was the market was cheap and getting cheaper until the end of 2009. Yeah, and now we've come back up to the trend line. At the same time, if we do a mean, you know, there's lots of statistical terms to this, regression,
mm-hmm.
Which doesn't sound very good. But anyway, if you
pardon me, I'm regressing.
Yes, you regress. So if you do a mean regression, and put a line on the price to earnings ratio, which has nothing to do with trend lines. It's just what is the average, which is another word for mean. What is the average price to earnings ratio over a long period of time? You see that the S&P 500 has been below its traditional average price to earnings ratio since 2009. Well, it's no longer below it. It's right on it. So we have multiple, and there's other things too, but there's multiple indicators that say we're done with the recovery. And just as we're done with the recovery, we've gone back to this is where we are normally through history. This is our average. All of a sudden, people stop worrying about the market crashing or begin to stop worrying about the market crashing and now are far more concerned about missing the upswing in the market. And by the way, I wrote a week ago that in our newsletter that one of the good news pieces about this bull market so far is that the individual investor has not started participating. The individual investors
have been
net sellers. In the last week, that's turned around.
Yeah.
Since I wrote it a week ago, the individual investors have started piling in and the cash flows have reversed and people are starting to buy stock mutual funds again as opposed to buying into as heavily into bonds. There's still people buying bonds,
right?
Which we can talk about.
Yeah, the bond market at the same time has begun to see what we've been talking about for years. Now, what we've been talking about is interest rates are going up. By the way, just to throw this in here, the yield curve this week didn't flatten. It spread apart. It was doing a healthy thing, which makes me happy. Long-term rates went up faster than short-term rates.
You know, unlike a tire, the yield curve will actually pump itself up, and it has pumped itself up this week very nicely. The Standard & Poor's, the 10-year U.S. Treasury, which is the benchmark, crossed the 2.5,
That's the yield, yeah.
The yield 2.5. And to give you some feel for how significant that was, 4 months ago, the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note was 2%.
It's come up 0.5% since then. So as a percentage change.
Right. It's actually a 27% increase in interest rates
right.
in 4 months.
Which had a negative impact on the principal value of already owned bonds. Now, all of this is kind of esoteric. What does it mean to people today? Number one, we're not saying don't invest money if you suddenly have money to invest. What we are saying is that if you're going about your business, and let me kind of backtrack a little bit and say what people do wrong. And in economies that are in recovery, people tend to pay off their debt and raise their savings and postpone investment. That's not the right thing to do. In a recovering economy, you should be allocating some money to debt payoff. You should be allocating some money to savings, and you should be investing as much as you can. In a nice economy that people are optimistic about, people tend to take on more debt, tend to spend their savings, and invest as much as they can because they missed the part during that recovery. Now, that's the opposite thing you should be doing right now. I'm not saying you shouldn't be investing. What I am saying is that you should be in good times, in times where things are profitable, when you are doing better than you have before, you should be paying down debt now. You should be building up your savings now. Because one thing that I can tell you with a great deal of surety, we're going to have other downtimes. Now is the time to prepare for those downtimes. People tend to get shocked by the downtime, and after the downtime hits, they start preparing for the downtime. If you prepare now, it's a lot less painful. We call it dry powder. Build up your dry powder today. If you depleted it because you were coming out of this recovery, if you've got more debt and you've got less cash, or you're starting to take on more debt, you shouldn't take on more debt in the best times. You should be taking on less debt now. And unfortunately, that's not the way we behave.
It ain't going to work that way. People get optimistic.
What we can say is that hopefully the people listening to this program are actually listening to this program and they do those actions. But most people do not, which is why some people make a lot of money in the market and the majority of people just break even or a little bit better.
So here's some things that are fairly obvious if you know much about economics, but since there's not a lot of education about economics given in the public system or in the normal university degree or anything else, it's probably worth knowing. Interest rates are headed upward. And the reason I can say that is we saw, and a lot of the numbers we just talked about were driven by the fact that we saw an increase in inflation in December's numbers. And if you annualize those numbers, and again, that can be dangerous, but still, If you look at the last several months' numbers, we've noticed that each month inflation tends to grow a little more. And we're talking about core inflation here. We're not talking about the volatile side of it. And if we take what happened in December and we look at it on an annualized basis, we realize that we could have 3.7% inflation in 2018. Do I think we're going to have 3.7? No. But we could, and there's some really good reasons that we can reasonably expect inflation to come along. One is the dollar consistently is falling. It's been falling for a while, which makes the price of gold look better, which makes the price of oil look better because people are buying it overseas and it runs up the price in U.S. dollars, not because it's run up that much in reality, but simply because the value of the dollar has fallen really quite a lot since the beginning of the year. And there's a lot of good reasons for that, and it's really in many ways good for the United States because our exports sell better. But
yeah, I'll tell you the big reason why people – we talk about the fall of the dollar, and they almost sound like it's a competition. No, don't let that happen. When the dollar's falling, it's really, really
3 minutes
good
stations
for our exports. It's excellent for our exports. People can buy more of them. That's a good thing.
Makes them more competitive.
Right. And the reason why the dollar is falling, where just 3 or 4 years ago we were talking about the dollar going up in value and how we were worried about that, is because we were doing quantitative easing. Our central bank was buying bonds, well, and that was keeping interest rates low but higher than the rest of the world. They had negative interest rates. So people were sending all their money here, which was a lot of people buying dollars, which caused the price of the dollar to go up against those other currencies. Well, now we're not doing quantitative easing. Our interest rates are starting to come up, so we are getting some money from overseas. But the other central banks are buying huge amounts of their euro-backed or Japanese currency-backed or Chinese currency-backed or any specific currency is being subsidized, if you will, by their central banks, which causes their value to go up.
Well, the interest rates in Europe started up too. And the people in Europe who were buying U.S. bonds are now more likely to buy European bonds. The other thing is, very frankly, it's called jawboning.
Jawboning?
Yes.
As in like Samson and a donkey? Yeah,
as in somebody who talks and causes something to happen. Very frankly, the United States is not particularly popular overseas right now. And as a result, there is a noticeable tendency for people who previously bought U.S. treasuries
to not buy U.S. treasuries.
To not buy U.S. treasuries, which causes our interest rates to go up.
Which causes those that do hold U.S. treasuries value to drop.
Right. And so
if they hold to a maturity, they'll get their money back.
Well, minus inflation.
Unless they bought high.
This is the point I want to make. As the dollar falls, the price of imports go up, and we import a lot. As a matter of fact, we broke a record last month for imports from China. And as the import prices go up, that naturally is going to generate inflation because you're paying a little more for something.
I just wanted to throw this in there. We broke a record not just for imports from China, for imports in general. We've never imported that much. We've never exported as much either. Two big records. So go ahead.
But the point is, inflation is all the indicators say we are on the verge of experiencing some inflation. How much? Are we going to have runaway inflation? I don't think so. But we are the mere fact that the that we can afford to raise the prices on things and them still be cheaper overseas, the fact that stuff we import is going to cost more, which has got to be passed along, and you throw in that a majority of economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal, like 90%, say we're either at or very, very near to full inflation, which means
full employment,
which means that there is a shortage of workers, and there's anecdotal information that the Federal Reserve chairman and the various regions are reporting, and I've heard, and everybody who studies this is listening to, from employers saying they're having a lot of trouble finding people to hire. In other words, it's more jobs that aren't going to do us any good because we don't have anybody to work. And at some point, the competition for workers will start to trigger
wage
higher prices to pay those workers. And even the tax cut, which will increase their wages a little bit, their take home wages, is going to have that effect over time. And the reason I say that is, we've talked about this before, a lot of companies are going to be hiring robots.
Yeah. Now, only it's not called hiring, it's called buying robots.
And rather than people. And they're going to have to pay the people who operate the robots more because they're going to have more education and more skills. So everything out there says inflation is going up. Inflation goes up, interest rates go up with it. And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Well, I just got a question for you. Since how we are short on labor, and that is true, everybody I talk to cannot find any labor to do any work.
Right.
If that is true, then why do our politicians want to take all the 850,000 DACA people and put them in college so they can get a degree in underwater basket weaving? Why don't they put them in a job skill?
No, they're not trying to put them in college to get degrees in underwater basket weaving. They're trying to kick them out of the country.
Now, the majority right now. What, say that again?
I mean, the president wants to have them booted, right?
Well, and I don't know we necessarily need to boot them, but I'm just saying I don't think the taxpayer needs to give them a student loan so they can go do something for 4 years. When if they put them in a trade school and they teach them how to weld or carpenter or roof or whatever.
But that's a student loan, too.
Why don't we do that?
Well, but most of them do wind up getting productive degrees. That's an interesting thing. I've read the statistics on that. Apparently, that particular group of people, because their parents are not well off, because they really need to find a job, get very, very practical educations. Now, it's the people whose parents are quite well off who know they can fall back on their parents, who really don't feel like they need to make a living anyway.
That's where the underwater basket weaving
comes where the underwater basket weaving comes
from. The spoiled people that have never had to figure out what to do that tend to get the degrees that can't be used, like art history. Well, what are you going to do with that? Well, I'm going to go be a coach.
The heads of most of the major corporations in the United States right now are lobbying the president and Congress to not kick these people out of the country because we need them as workers. And a lot of them, by the way, are already employed.
Yeah.
And they're working in corporations, and several major corporations have said they are going to have to get rid of a significant portion of their workforce if the DACA people who are holding the little cards suddenly are rendered illegal, which could happen in just a few days.
And this is a big piece of that. You mentioned this. I want to bring it up. We mentioned student loans. Student loans are subsidized by the U.S. government in a lot of cases. The Department of Education does this. There's a lot of people that are upset about it. Why are we giving out loans to kids and so on? If we look at the debt of the United States government, not every all of the citizens, one of the things that balances our debt as a nation is the asset of loaning money to someone else. We've got about getting up close to $4 trillion of debt that's owed back, that's interest-paid debt, and it's
paid fairly well. Now, yeah. Sometimes there's delinquencies, but it takes longer because it's like an IRS debt. You really have to pay it back. There's a danger, though. It's a very great investment in our system in that for an education, it's just as an example. If you spend $100,000 to go to college, hopefully you have a degree that has the for that much money, has the ability to pay you close to that much every year for the rest of your life. That's a pretty good investment. And so the GI Bill was great. The student loan system, while it's got some major breaks in it, it long-term is a good investment in our economy. However, if we've just given one of those loans to a DACA person and then we kick them out of the country, we can just write that loan off as gone. So this is one of the difficulties of one administration making a policy that a second administration completely revokes when it comes to a long-term decision process. Any long-term decision process needs to be made with long-term information. And if every administration comes in and kicks out the prior administration's decisions, it's very difficult long-term. I mean, if you're talking about a bank instead of a government sponsored loan, if a bank were giving a loan to someone and somewhere written in the loan document is the possibility that this person's going to get kicked out of the country and not be able to pay the loan back, that loan's not going to get made. Where these student loans are being given to DACA folks based on the fact that we're looking at the Republicans and the Democrats just a year and a half ago, we're looking at this group of people and saying this group of people is likely to be here forever. That's been shifted. I'm not saying good or bad things about this. What I am saying is that economically, it's very difficult to make decisions if the information keeps getting changed.
And we're not being political about this. Right now, it's a simple economics issue, and these CEOs have stated it very clearly. And that is, they don't have other people they can hire if they're suddenly forced to fire several million employees.
And there's a lot of military folks that are DACA. And if we deport all of them, then we will be dishonorably discharging people who are in Afghanistan, who are in Iraq, who are in Kosovo.
No, it's not a dishonorable. It's an administrative discharge.
Oh, okay, an administrative discharge from the military because they're no longer qualified to be there. So all of the benefits that we promised them for their sacrifice for us disappears. So there's there's some real issues here
and
that we have to deal with.
I know that this whole situation is a lot more complicated than my simple brain can understand, but it just seems to me that all of our politicians have an insatiable desire to figure out how to spend more money, and it's taxpayer money.
Yep.
And they never seem to reduce any federal agency or any student loan program. They just increase. And that really concerned me because how can you continue to put air in that bubble without breaking the bubble?
Well, now I'm interested in your take on something then, since you probably have very much the same view we do about this. I've been trying to find somebody on the right-wing side of things who will explain?
You think I'm on the right?
You are definitely on the right. Who will explain to me the rationale behind, conservatively speaking, increasing the U.S. deficit by $2 trillion in order to give us a tax cut in the middle of full employment and an economic boom?
Well, like I say, that's too complicated for my.
I really want to understand somebody who will defend increasing the deficit by $2 trillion by the same people who said the deficit just a year ago, they were saying the deficit was too high, and unless you can reduce the deficit and come closer to a balanced budget, we're going to shut the government down. I'm trying really hard to get my mind around this.
Well, I can answer that, and it really doesn't have to.
I want him to answer.
Okay.
You got any idea?
How many people do you know that understands what $1 trillion is?
Well, that's
zero.
I've never met one. That's neither here nor there. The point is increasing the deficit hugely, if you just want to use a simple term, to give everybody a tax cut when we have full employment. And, I mean, this is the time when rationally, if you're running a business or a family, times are good, good times are rolling.
Pay off the debt.
This is the time where you would raise taxes to pay down some of the debt.
So then you're ready for the next downturn.
Well, they're operating on emotion, not common sense. The definition, somebody explained what $1 trillion is. If you throw a dollar bill out the window every second, it will take you 31,000 years to throw out $1 trillion.
Well, a trillion is $1,000 billion. A billion is $1,000 million. So it's $1,000 million.
But when you say that, the general public don't have the foggiest notion of what $1 trillion is.
Forget the number. Just simply say, why is the same party that when it was not in power was so adamantly for reducing the deficit, consciously and intentionally just dramatically increase the deficit? That's a simple question.
I think the general public who votes for politicians do not comprehend what you're talking about. And I believe that. I believe the man on the street, the common man, he does not know what $1 trillion is and cannot comprehend.
It's not a matter of $1 trillion. It's we all know the we all know that our federal debt is high and keeps getting higher, and at some point down the road it's going to be unsustainable. Making it worse consciously to give everybody a little more money in their pocket in an election year kind of smacks to me of hypocrisy.
Well, it does. But I'm just saying people can't comprehend the idea that if you want to stop spending more money than you're bringing in, cut the spending. You know, Lynn Woolley mentioned.
You're never going to get elected.
I probably won't. But yeah, if we cut every federal agency 25%, you would never miss them. But if you cut it 5%, look at how much you would save. And why not try that? Why not cut our federal spending 5% across the board? Everybody.
Well, I can actually give you a lot of good reasons for that.
We just did that, actually. It was called sequestration, and it wasn't cut across the board. The mandatory stuff wasn't cut, so there wasn't Social Security cuts or Medicare cuts or defense was cut, but not defense retirement.
Let me ask you this question. Are you in favor of having Social Security, Medicare, Social Security, and defense all cut by 5%?
I am in favor of that if they would cut everything.
No.
Welfare, food stamps, everything.
The others are easy. They have been cut that much. The problem is that the three I just mentioned eat up the total, all the taxes that are paid, and then some.
Yeah, all the revenue goes towards those three major things.
You can cut all the other programs completely out, and we still have a huge deficit. The point is, the three big ones that occupy about 85% of the spending of the government, mentioned.
And I would say you are an extreme minority in saying you would be okay with that because most people receiving Social Security and Medicare, if somebody told them that they were going to have 5% cut, they may need Medicare immediately afterwards because they'd be hospitalized.
If the government came out today, if the president came out today and says, okay, we're going to work on balancing the budget. We've just done a big tax cut. So it used to be 5%, Lynn Woolley was talking about. So let's go to 10%. Let's cut your Social Security by 10%. Let's cut your Medicare payments by 10%. And we'll cut the military spending by 10%.
Well, that means the Democrats get elected. That's what happens there, because people right now do not, as much as we say it, as much as the majority of the American population says, yes, I would love to see a balanced budget, when it comes to the actual cutting, a very tiny minority is what's remaining that says, yes, we should have a balanced budget. As long as we're talking about other people's programs, it's fine, but anything that benefits me, don't touch that. And that's the entitlement mentality. It's become the mentality of the American people. Until we're ready to deal with that attitude, we're not going to have a balanced budget. We're going to accrue more debt. And we've got to play some commercials.
Okay, I want to say one last thing. Caller, let me tell you something. Before the tax cut, if we just left everything alone, over the next decade, the deficit each year, according to the Congressional Budget Office, was gradually going to be shrinking because the economy would grow faster than the deficit. With the tax cut, it will be growing. Like I said, I don't get it. Well, thanks for your call.
Anyway. Yeah, we appreciate the call. We'll be
playing some commercials now. If this is the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure, we welcome your phone calls. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more from the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake
McClure.
You notice when he says starring, I'm completely off. I forget to say my name. Anyway, telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, and we're talking about some of the big things. Let's assume that interest rates are going up and inflation is returning. It is. I don't think we're going to have runaway inflation. I do think if you pump a lot of extra money into the economy at this point, a couple of things will happen. One, we will start to get some inflation. And two, the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates a little faster than they anticipated raising interest rates, which will take some of the steam out of the system. But it's going to be interesting to see. But here's the point I wanted to make. It's important to understand that as interest rates go up, the value of a bond that you own goes down. That's number one. Number two, don't depend on real estate appreciating a lot in the near future. There's going to be exceptions to that where there's a high demand for something. But two things tend to drive, if there's nothing else going on, there's two things that tend to drive the price of real estate. And one of those things is interest rates, because when people buy real estate, they normally don't buy it in cash, either commercial or residential real estate. They get a loan. They get a mortgage. And the higher the mortgage, the more it costs them per month to hold the real estate. So that is interest rates start up.
House prices are definitely going to have a downward pressure.
And there's a second
issue. Not going to be right away, but it'll happen.
There's a second issue that's probably going to cause a downward pressure in house prices. And it is the lack of deductibility above $10,000 on mortgage interest, which means that the cost of owning a house and the attractiveness of buying a house, now it's $10,000 on the property tax. It's, $500,000?
Yeah, you've got it.
$750,000. And $750,000 sounds like a lot of money for a house.
Not in Boston.
But not on the East Coast or West Coast.
Or in Austin.
And as a result, when the house prices for the upper-end houses start to come down,
that puts a downward pressure on all housing.
The rest of housing is going to tend to come down with it, because some of the people that would have bought, let's say, a $400,000 house suddenly realize that they can afford to buy a further upstream house because the price has come down, so they don't buy the $400,000 house.
Which causes the $400,000 house price to have to come down because the people down below can afford. So that's, it's a downward pressure starting at the top, which is where downward pressure comes from.
So the tax law change, the tax law change had some interesting effects besides that.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of interesting things. They finally made it through the whole thing.
Yeah, one of them is, you're probably already familiar with this, if you're farming out there right now and you choose to sell to a co-op, you basically just created tax-free farming. Even if you make a 20% profit, you will still – so for every $100, every $1,000 you spent on your farm this year, you made $1,200 and you had a 20% profit. Well, guess what? You can just write the whole thing off. And it's tax-free farming because of the way the tax bill was written. They didn't stop and think about it very long. A couple of senators have said, oh, no, this is wrong. We're going to have to change this. The USDA says, oh, yeah, we'll have to change this, because you only get the tax-free farming if you sell to a co-op. If you try to sell to a small business that owns a grain elevator, let's say you're producing corn and Joe Smith down the road has a grain elevator and his family's had it for 80 years and they've always been the people you sold your grain to. Well, you don't get the 20% tax write-off for selling to him. You can only get the 20% tax write-off if you sell to a farmer's co-op.
Well, here's what's happening already. This is a important. It's already beginning. There are farmers' co-ops being started by the farmers that were selling to that grain place. So you've just raised your grain. You turn around, you sell it to this new co-op that you just helped found. That co-op then turns around and sells it for the same price it bought it for, so no profit, to the place that it's been that the farmers have been selling the whole time, and that's just removed the income tax from the entire transaction. Everywhere along the line, no income tax is due.
Isn't that neat?
That's really amazing.
It's good for farmers, but there's a secondary effect that I've not read much about, but it's definitely there. We effectively just violated almost every international food trading agreement we have, and we'll almost be certainly sued.
International court lawsuits are about to start going through the roof because all of our corn, all of our grain,
subsidized. We just subsidized by making farmers tax-free. We just subsidized food production in the United States hugely, as to use the president's term. And
Bigly.
Really bigly. Really bigly. And the World Trade Organization and the treaties we've signed off on says, no, you can't cheat that way.
You can't just say this group of people doesn't pay taxes on exports.
And we just got through shutting down softwood lumber imports from Canada.
For exactly this. Exactly.
Because of the tax rules, the Canadian government effectively was subsidizing the production of softwood in Canada, and they were exporting it to the United States. So
the subsidy wasn't – they weren't turning –
we blocked the import of it.
Yeah, they weren't – the government wasn't going to the lumber companies and saying, here, have some money. Instead, they were just saying, we're not going to charge you taxes, which
– Well, they actually didn't say we're not going to charge you any taxes. We're just going to give you a tax break.
You're right. And in this case, what we're talking about now, this new tax change for the farmers, is in essence tax-free status on your crops.
And here's the issue. Well, they could issue a Technical Corrections Act, except it ain't going to happen. And let me tell you why the Technical Corrections Act is not going to happen. The tax bill passed with a 51 vote margin
in the Senate.
In the Senate. In order to get the Technical Corrections Act through, you're going to have 60 senators.
Right. That's never going
to
happen.
It's very unlikely to happen. And Secretary Mnuchin says he didn't think it's necessary.
One good impact of this, which could be long-term very bad for the farmers, it's going to cause the price of grain and the price of American-grown items to drop. Well, how could that be bad for the farmer? Well, right now it's not. They don't have to pay taxes. The price is coming down, but it's probably not going to come down as much as they're saving in taxes, so it's a net profit for now. But at some point, either through an arbitrary ruling or a well-thought-out system, this is going to get reversed, which will cause the final death knell to human farming in the United States. Because it will not be – when we have a – because farm
– No, we still got way too many tax breaks for farming for humans to get out of it.
Well, here's the thing. If we reverse this one, and this is going to cause a drop in food prices. There's no way around that. The prices are going to drop. It's not going to drop right away. You have to wait for taxes to not get paid before you can drop the price. So you've got a lag, and we talk about this lag a couple of weeks ago. We talked about it with the corn hog cycle. There's a lag, and sometimes it's a 3-year lag. If you go and you buy your beginning items for a crop, you raise the crop and you sell it, that doesn't happen overnight. It has a pretty significant weather-based lag. When that happens, seasonal-based lag, when that happens, when the price does come down, it adjusts what we spend for the next year, which is another lag. So once we see the prices drop this year, it's going to affect the prices for the next several years just because it's the price of this year.
Yep.
And when the arbitrary rule comes in and swaps that around – profits will be lowered by that point because competition will be around. People will be pushing each other out of the business. When there's this much money to be gained, the beginning starts with a lot of wildcatters coming out and jumping into the farming world. Hey, you can do this tax-free now. You get a lot of competition, which is a big downward press on the prices.
And there'll be loans made to buy farms and buy equipment based on
low price, no taxes.
Based on the tax advantages. I mean, the tax advantage to farming right now,
it's
just as begging the farmers to borrow a lot of money or investors, which is more likely what will happen, to get into limited partnerships, borrow a lot of money, buy a lot of stuff to go on the farm because it's tax-free income.
Right. Tax hikes don't take place in the same way as – I mean, not tax hikes. Price hikes don't take place at the same speed as price drops. Price drops tend to take place over a longer period of time. They drop over and drop over and drop over. Price increases tend to, and particularly when they're tax related, tend to happen overnight. So imagine you're a farmer. You've just sold your crop, because this is generally when it's going to happen. Just sold your crop, just made your money from the crop. You turn around and suddenly all the prices just go up when you're about ready to buy your next set of seed corn or your next set of beginning whatever. You realize you don't have enough money to have the same size crop as you had last year, and your debt is due. All the debt that you got into because of this wonderful thing. And that's we were talking about earlier. If you can't trust the government to keep a policy, you really can't make long-term decisions based on policies of government. And a lot of people are about to make some long-term decisions on farming. We're about out of time for this hour.
We are.
Yeah. I mean, this is a strange subject. We've got a lot to talk about next hour. I wanted to talk about the new blended retirement system for the military. I know a lot of military folks are listening. We'll get into that a little bit. We're going to talk about retirement programs and the fiduciary rule and where it might come from and all that good stuff. But if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give advice, fiduciary advice to high net worth folks. If you don't know what that is, you can call in and talk to us, and we won't get rid of you until we've had lots of conversation and it's mutual. The long-term implications of all this different stuff is part of what we talk about. The number to call locally is
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Listen to podcasts, read our newsletter. And until next hour, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. KTEM. Serving Central Texas. KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.